This is Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins, and it's Friday. That means Week in Review. Let's dive right in now with a vote by Boston City Council to regulate short-term housing rentals such as HomeAway and Airbnb.
There are 11 votes in favor and 2 votes in opposition. The docket number 0764 passes.
The measure bans people from using these websites to rent out units that they don't live in. City Councilor Matt O'Malley says the new rules will ease Boston's housing crunch.
I support the innovation economy. I use the innovation economy. But as a legislator, I need to make sure that we are balancing both the opportunities for folks to be an Airbnb-type host, as well as the fact that it has removed thousands of units from our rolls of availability.
But then there's the argument of Andrew Scalaban, founder of the Boston Host Alliance. The group represents short-term rental operators and service providers in Boston. He's disappointed, and he says Cambridge's experience proves these regulations will not bring down costs. Cambridge has already restricted who can operate short-term rentals.
The big argument is that we're driving up housing prices, and once they get back all of these Airbnbs, that rent is just going to go plummeting. And Cambridge is a prime example where that didn't happen and actually went up 3.1% in the last year.
Our figures say the hike was between 2 and 3% on average. Is this a good move for the city of Boston? Joining us to talk about this and other issues, John Carroll, Boston University journalism professor and WBUR senior news analyst. Nice to see you, John.
Good to be here.
Also with us, Joe Battenfeld, Boston Herald political reporter and columnist, host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, welcome to you.
Thank you, Lisa.
So these are some of the most rigid short-term rental regulations in the country. These new rules essentially ban investors and tenants from renting homes by the night, but they do allow homeowners and owner-occupants of 2- and 3-family houses to do so. Joe, you first. Given the tight housing market, is this a smart move by Boston City Council?
I find it to be a pretty devastating move. It's devastating for the short-term rental business. I think it's going to really put a dent in their business. It's going to cost people their jobs who work in that business. And I find it, frankly, to be an overreaction on the part of the Boston City Council. This is, as the person said before, I don't think this is going to do anything to lower the prices of apartments in Boston or solve the affordability crisis that's going on in Boston.
Well, no surprise, Airbnb agrees with you. The company released a statement that read in part, "The new ordinance unfortunately creates a system that violates the privacy of our hosts and prevents Boston families from making much-needed extra income in one of the country's most expensive cities." HomeAway said the outcome here will have dangerous consequences for Boston's travel and tourism economy. John Carroll, what do you think?
Well, Airbnb has used a sort of a misdirection play from the very start here. They keep talking about Boston families. They keep talking about making ends meet, privacy. The issue here is really mostly about investor-owned units. And those are the ones that are being regulated the most. And those are the ones that are basically being regulated out of the field. So I think that the whole idea that this is hurting individual Bostonians could be true in some situations, but it's not entirely true, and it's not the focus of these regulations. That said, Airbnb is terrific at end-running these kinds of regulations. Look to New Orleans, where basically they've changed their practices so that it's much harder to track short-term rentals in New Orleans. And they have some pretty stringent regulations. So I think it's going to be whether Boston can actually implement and enforce these regulations as opposed to what's happened in other cities.
So here's what Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley said. She's also, as we know, a congressional candidate. She supported the ban.
Short-term rentals are contributing to this public health crisis and epidemic that is the affordable housing crisis, and without regulation or data collection stands to become an even larger contributor to displacement.
So to that point, is this an appropriate solution to the lack of housing in the Boston area? What do you think,
Joe? Well, the affordable housing crisis has been going on long before the short-term rental business even really got going. This has been going on for a long time. I do think it's better that they ban, if they're going to ban anything, investor-owned apartments from this. But at the same time, they're also making everybody sign up and register for this, you know, anybody who does a short-term, which I find to be extremely unworkable. And it's going, you know, how do you even do that? How do you?
I'm
how do people?
Why? So what you're saying is the hosts have to register their space with the city and pay a $200 fee.
How do you enforce that exactly?
John, do you see that as a problem?
I think it is going to be a problem, and the city is calling upon Airbnb and HomeAway and the other short-term rental companies to self-report every month and to be basically policing their listings. And I think that may be a fatal flaw here, because whether they will submit these reports or not is one thing, but whether they'll be accurate or not is another thing. So I think that the affordable housing crisis is something that is not going to be solved by this by any means. I mean, you're talking about 2,000 units at the highest estimate. So that's not even going to make a dent in the affordable housing problems that we have. So I think that this is a side issue, and it shouldn't divert people from addressing the serious affordable housing crisis that Boston and a lot of cities and towns in Massachusetts have.
It's a politically expedient way of saying, oh, we're doing something to solve the affordable housing crisis, when it goes, like John said, the crisis, the problem goes much deeper than this. And, politicians can do a lot different things than this to solve it.
Which if companies like Amazon end up moving to Boston, if that does happen, they're really going to have their hands full.
Yeah.
So let's shift to the statewide issue for a few minutes here of recreational marijuana, because in a little over 2 weeks, sales will become legal in Massachusetts, July 1st, the target date when shops open. But it seems less and less likely that any actually will open on that date, because the state's Cannabis Control Commission met yesterday. It has yet to issue a single business license for pot shops. Here's Steve Hoffman, who's chair of the Cannabis Control Commission, speaking to reporters.
Other states that rushed to hit an arbitrary deadline ended up with no inventory. In some cases, ended up with no licenses in place, no background checks being done, no online inventory being done. We are not going to do that. We're going to get it right. If that means we have few or no stores on July 1st and it takes a few more weeks, I hope and expect that everybody in the state believes that's the right thing to do. We certainly believe that's the right thing to do.
John Carroll, do you think it's the right thing to do? Could the commissioners be accused of foot dragging?
Well, this is moving so slowly, you'd think that maybe they're dipping into the merchandise, except that 4 out of 5 of the commissioners were against the ballot question when it first came up in 2016.
Do you think they're just then foot dragging or just being cautious?
I think there's a certain amount of foot dragging. I think there's a certain amount of incompetence involved here, too. I mean, the rollout of medical marijuana was just as sort of halting as this one is. And it's already been delayed for 6 months. And that's one of the issues that critics are bringing up mostly, that it was supposed to, these pot shops were supposed to be in effect January 1st. The legislature put them off. And they're saying, Hoffman says, these are sort of goals, not a legislative mandate. It is a legislative mandate. The legislation says on and after July 1st, licenses shall be issued by the commission. And so I think that they've missed the legislative deadline, and I think that that they should be held accountable for that.
Joe, what do you think is going on here?
What a shock that Massachusetts as a government is not ready for a mandate to enact a law that was approved by the voters. This is a voter-approved law.
Do you think it's not respecting the will of the voters?
I don't think it is, but at the same time, I kind of agree with the chairman that they shouldn't be rushing it. If they're not ready for it, they should be ready for it, first of all. And they're not ready for it. They should have been.
But, let's look at the other point. I mean, they're really carving new ground here.
Right. Yeah, they are, but they've had time to get ready for this. And, they've known about it for a long time. In fact, this was actually delayed from what the initial law said it should be. So they should have been ready. But I think it's probably smart, if they're not ready, to wait and until they've got all their act together.
On the other hand, there's a decided lack of urgency in the commission. They had a meeting yesterday, and they did not talk about licenses at that meeting. They talked about regulatory housekeeping. They talked about what are the metrics we're going to publicly report on to assess the performance of the commission, which those metrics they better hope they don't come out too soon. I think that they don't seem to feel that there is this real sense of urgency to this, that there are a lot of business people who are waiting and are sort of in limbo right now, because they want to make plans. They have plans. They've made investments, and they're sort of stuck in nowhere.
Yeah. And even when they do approve the first few retail shops or cultivation facilities. I think it's going to be very, very slow rolling out.
Which is a bad thing, or
yeah,
not?
I think it's a bad. I think again, typical of Massachusetts government.
Okay, again, as Steve Hoffman of the Cannabis Control Commission says, they are doing background checks. They have to make sure that they have the inventory, et cetera. Something else that happened this week: the Special Commission on Operating Under the Influence and Impaired Driving met to talk about driving under the influence of legalized marijuana, because the state expects that's going to be a big problem after July 1st, or whenever the shops actually happen to be open. Last fall, we should say, the state Supreme Judicial Court ruled that field sobriety tests are not conclusive evidence of intoxication by marijuana. Let's hear what Walpole's Police Chief John Carmichael said this week. He was talking about how officers are conducting what is now called a roadside assessment for sobriety, but he says there's no formal process yet for pot DUI arrests.
The officer has to make some determination based on the circumstances as to whether or not they're going to bring that person in at arrest, or they have to make some determination that that person is free to leave and that they'll be okay.
And that point concerns Matt Allen of the Massachusetts chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union.
We want to make sure that that kind of test doesn't result in people being criminalized, particularly medical marijuana patients who may be marijuana users but may not be intoxicated.
So, gentlemen, from your perspectives, what's going on here? John?
Well, I think this is going to be really difficult, because virtually every court case looks like it would be a jump ball. It would be the word of the officer against the word of the driver. And until they can come up with a test, and I think there's a test in
Colorado.
Somewhere. That basically measures your pupils, the pupils of your eye. And I think that may be helpful, but I think that's also filled
sketchy
with all kinds of,
yeah.
Right. I mean, there could be any number of reasons why your pupils are dilated. So I think this is going to be very difficult for the police to manage, and it's going to call for a lot of judgment, and there's going to be a lot of second guessing.
It's going to be a real problem. With no way of adequately measuring whether somebody is stoned or how stoned they are, I think the judge is going to throw out the case unless they have some evidence that the person beyond pupils or looking at their pupils or glassy eyes or whatever the cops say, it's kind of a difficult thing to prove.
We should say that Colorado, by the way, has established a certain THC level that is enough to charge someone there with DUI, although it still says that the science is not 100% on this. Senator Elizabeth Warren spoke to WBUR this week. She has introduced a new bill in Washington. It's called the States Act, which would allow states to pass their own marijuana laws without any kind of interference from the federal government. So Massachusetts law would trump federal law on this issue. President Trump said that he's willing to support the measure. Here's Liz Warren.
Folks in Massachusetts, just like folks in Colorado, got together and said, here's how we want to treat marijuana in Massachusetts. And now that that's the case, we think the federal government just ought to back off.
We should say the bill is co-sponsored by Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado. Joe, do you think it's a good idea?
I do think it's a good idea. I think you know that this is going to be. There's already a conflict between the states and the federal government that's looming. The federal government's still saying that pot should not be legal, and states, you know, enacting it all over the country. So I hope that this doesn't drag out in Washington, and that they get that they pass this.
John, on the other hand, Attorney General Jeff Sessions told Colorado Public Radio at the end of last week that he's waiting to see what comes of this legislation, but he will continue to enforce federal law as it's now written. Let's hear him.
The federal law remains in effect nationwide, just like it does for heroin or cocaine. Of course, it's not the death-dealing drug in the same way that fentanyl or heroin is, but it remains on the books as a prohibited substance.
Shot across the bow of Massachusetts?
Possibly, although the U.S. attorney here has said he's not interested in pursuing this right now. It's not high on his priorities list. And I think that that's the safeguard. I think this is the kind of legislation that's going to have a lot of trouble getting through Capitol Hill. And I think that if Jeff Sessions wants to start arm twisting, it could get much more complicated. But if it stays the status quo, I think most U.S. attorneys are just sitting back and letting nature take its course.
Is that something you can see Jeff Sessions doing, arm twisting?
A little bit, yeah.
We have one more local story with a national impact. Attorney General Maura Healey of Massachusetts is suing Purdue Pharma, maker of the powerful painkiller OxyContin. The state's Department of Public Health estimates that last year there were more than 2,000 opioid-related overdose deaths in the state. And Healy announced the civil suit against the company's top executives and family members of Raymond Sackler, Purdue Pharma's founder. Last June, Maura Healy and more than 35 other attorneys general announced a joint investigation into the marketing practices of manufacturers of opioids. And at a press conference, she said their investigation found that the individuals created the opioid epidemic and, quote, profited from it through a web of illegal deceit.
We found that Purdue misled doctors, patients, and the public about the real risks of their dangerous opioids, including OxyContin. We also found that they did this with the oversight and direction of 16 current and former executives and directors named in our complaint. Their strategy was simple. The more drugs they sold, the more money they made. And the more people died.
Purdue Pharma responded in a statement saying it is vigorously denying Healy's allegations and that its executives are, quote, disappointed that in the midst of good faith negotiations with many states, the Commonwealth has decided to pursue a costly and protracted litigation process. So question for you both. This is the first state lawsuit to name a company's top executives as being responsible. What do you make of this attempt at personal culpability, Joe?
I think, to be honest, it's partly a political stunt on Healy's part. It's a serious issue, and the evidence would suggest that actually the illicit fentanyl and heroin are the real problem. That's what's killing people right now, not even prescription drugs. People who are actually prescribed drugs are not the ones that are overdosing for by and large. So I think in partly it's a political reaction to a very complicated problem, a serious problem, but that she's looking to score political points.
John. Well, I think you can look at this in a couple of different ways. One is the current heroin epidemic is to some degree fueled by OxyContin and Purdue Pharmacy, because initially drug users were crushing and snorting the pills. Purdue reformulated the pills so that they can't be crushed and snorted in that way, and that has driven people to heroin and fentanyl and cheaper options. So there is that connection there. The other thing I would say is a couple of weeks ago, the New York Times did a really big takeout on the 2007 prosecution or investigation of Purdue Pharma, where there was a $600 million settlement. And to look at that, it seems from the evidence that Purdue Pharma knew in the late 90s that this illicit street trade was going on. And you can find street value and crush and snort in their internal documents. And basically, they were able to negotiate a settlement. Rudy Giuliani was one of the lawyers that that helped them negotiate that settlement without any indictments. And that was something that laid the foundation for what's happening now.
And if that settlement hadn't been reached, then the prosecutors wanted to charge Purdue Pharma executives with felonies that could have sent them to prison. Ending with our usual weekly hubbubs, and I wonder, Joe, if you can tell us about a brief story event that caught your attention this week.
Some numbers that are sort of buried in a Suffolk University poll that came out yesterday. 60%, only 60% of Republicans in Massachusetts approve of Charlie Baker's performance. That's very low. And it's almost Democrats is almost 60% approval as well. So Baker is it's good news and bad news for Baker. The good news is he's very popular among Democrats, and it indicates he's likely to be reelected because most people do not associate Charlie Baker with Donald Trump. The Democrats are going to try to tie Trump to Baker, but I don't think they're going to be successful based on the results of this poll.
John, you're going to divert from politics?
Yes, I am, actually. My hubbub is about Kyrie Irving, who is not only a Boston Celtics star, but also a filmmaker. He has a film coming out at the end of the month called Uncle Drew. It's based on a character he developed for a series of Pepsi commercials. Pepsi-Cola paid for the screenplay, may have paid for other things as well. At any rate, he plays a 70-something geezer who goes around schooling young people about how to play basketball. Interesting thing was last week, the culture reporter for the Times, Soap and Deb, for the New York Times, had an interview with him. And the headline was, Kyrie Irving doesn't know if the earth is round or flat. He does want to discuss it. And here's the money quote. Irving says, can you openly admit that you know the earth is constitutionally round, like You know that for sure?
Constitutionally round is
constitutionally
the key
round,
there.
Right,
yeah, exactly.
Which leads to the inevitable sequel, Uncle Drew, Flat Earth, Round Ball, coming to a theater near you.
John Carroll, Boston University journalism professor and WBUR senior news analyst. Joe Battenfeld, Boston Herald political reporter and columnist, host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Nice to talk to you both. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's much more ahead. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is Radio Boston.